Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. 1 hour of politics, not enough. Let's continue. Although we're going to go a little bit national after doing the local scene. Meg Hubeck here, UVA Center for Politics. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you again.
Thank you so much for returning. Meg, Director of Instruction and the Youth Leadership Initiative and Global Perspectives on Democracy Programs.
I'm a busy person.
Can you put that all on one card?
No.
No. Ms. Hubeck traveled to Sri Lanka and Afghanistan for the United States State Department, has assisted in planning and implementing leadership programs for countries such as India and Bangladesh, Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, and Peru. But the Youth Leadership Initiative is her primary responsibility. She administrates and manages the programs of Youth Leadership Initiative, including the annual mock election, e-Congress, and Democracy Corps. Over 70,000 teachers use the resources of the Youth Leadership Initiative. Impressive.
I'm busy. I love it.
And yet you save an hour for Sunday morning wake-up call.
Well, it's nice when your job is also your passion. And so I'm really glad to be here today to kind of talk about what we've been doing at the Center for Politics and how we're trying to make politics a good thing again. I think our slogan used to be, a politics is a good thing. And I think we've been talking about politics can be a good thing if we're educated enough to know what that really means and how to do it in a way that promotes compromise and civility.
Well, we're going to do all of that within the hour. Talk about Great. What you've been doing, talk about what's been in the news, and get the perspective of the UVA Center for Politics, or at least your perspective on that. And how they all tie together.
Sure.
Because you've had some folks from Mongolia.
They're here right now. They've been here for about a week. We've got another, or about a week and a half, and we have another week with them. And what we're trying to do is increase civic engagement in Mongolia through leadership development, and also from bringing them here to get to know Americans and to get to know our country and how it works, so that they can bring some fresh ideas back to Mongolia. It's a great country. I'd love to go there.
Yeah, once we get a little further in the hour, I want to have you tell us what you've been doing to show them around. So we'll talk about that as well. So Meg Hubeck, again, from UVA Center for Politics here on Sunday morning Wake Up Call. So let's talk. Everybody's been talking about it. I don't want to miss out on our opportunity for a little bit to talk about the most recent debate among the Democratic candidates for 2020 for president. So I'm curious to get your perspective. 10 candidates remaining at this time. Where are we? 12, 13, 14 months away? Too many? Not enough? Too few?
Well, I think you hit on a key point, which was we're 14 months out. And so I think it's appropriate to have 10 if there are 10 people who are actually really serious and really viable in terms of not only securing a nomination, but also of making sure that the issues that the Democratic Party holds things are valuable to really shape that platform and what that's going to be going into 2020. I think we have a lot of things going on in our country. There are a lot of different issues that we really need to address. And so I don't think at this point 10 is too many. I will tell you anecdotally that we have an online mock election platform. And earlier this summer, I did a teacher workshop and I created a little activity for them to do that was, And I listed all of the Democratic candidates that were running for the nomination. And it was just, it took me so long and was such a huge list that I was like, oh no. You know, and I don't know if you remember when they first.
Who have you left out?
Remember when they had the 2 days of.
Right, back when
candidates.
They had 2 days, that was when there were, I think, 20, but really there were 24.
Right.
But they couldn't even get everybody on stage.
And it looked like a row of Pez dispensers.
Oh,
you know, they're all standing behind these platforms.
You can
with
only
their little,
see the heads.
You can only see their heads. They kind of look like Pez dispensers. I thought that was, that's a humorous thing, but I still think it spoke to, gosh, what a large number, but also the like real fervor that the Democrats have about doing something new, that we're willing to have all of these people step forward in such a diverse group, also very interesting and bringing a lot of different flavor and issue to what is eventually hopefully going to be the platform that they run on in 2020. So I think that's, I try to concentrate on the positive. So I like to think that, you know, in that 10 that are still remaining, the others that have left have added something to the conversation. So it should be very interesting to see where we go from here. I do think personally, from my own perspective, I'm not ready to make a decision yet because, as we said, we're 14 months out. There's a lot to consider. I want to see how the remaining candidates handle some different issues and making sure that they're including things that are important to myself in the discussion of policies that they would like to enact if nominated and then if they win the presidency. So I think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, I think a lot of people share my idea that it's just too far out to really hone in on a horse yet. So those people that are really backing a horse right now are your early adopters, as you would say, maybe in technology. And they're people that are really passionate, I think, about one issue or maybe two. And they have really backed the person that's speaking to those two issues or one issue that is really important to them. But I tend to be a more moderate voter. So if I was voting in the Democratic primary, I think I'd really want to see, you know, where that shapes up in terms of a true total party platform before I made my vote.
But here we are, we're talking about taking currently 10 and cutting it down multiple. I don't know how many we want to select a random number, but taking 10 down to 5. And we need to do that over the next few months. Iowa comes up in January, correct?
Yes.
And then I think what's after that?
New Hampshire.
And I think Nevada is an early state. But so we need to do this in the next 4 to 5 months. We're going to have another handful of candidates drop out. But in that time period, there's a debate in October. Then people spend just as much time focusing on the holidays as they're going to spend focusing on anything that's happening to the candidates, except some sort of headline, probably negative headline that's going to help them make a choice as to any candidate that they might drop rather than choose. Do you think I'm mistaken?
No, I don't think you're mistaken at all. And I think, you know, people are people. I love to go back to social psychology, right? We try to think we're very smart and that we've come a long way in terms of evolving our brains and how we think. But I don't think, the more I read about that, the less I think that's true. We're still doing the same dumb things we probably did 400 years ago. And so I think that there are always going to be those people who are more passionate about candidates and specific issues. And I think they're going to vote, they're going to be behind those I would say further to either end candidates. And so they come out early and often, right? But I just think a lot of people instead of, they're not going to pay attention until the last, until after Christmas is over.
How about the people, if we look at the bell curve, it's the people at either end of the bell curve who have already made their choice.
Yes, right. And they're backing that person. However, they were kind of the Bernie supporters in 2016, right? Bernie or nothing. And they got on that train, and then they stayed on that train. And then when that train left the station, they, a lot of them either didn't vote or vote for Trump, actually. There's evidence of that. Or voted for a third-party candidate. So I think you can only, you can't help who you are. And so I think, you know, yes, we have the holidays, we have other things that are going on. And I think that, those most Americans aren't going to make their mind up until it's wheedled down to that five or after the holidays. And, oh, now it's time to start thinking about a primary candidate. And who knows what will go on with the Republican Party, because there's a few people who are just kind of spinning around in the sky thinking about seeking the Republican nomination. So who knows what will happen with that?
Well, I thought they had already
decided fixed. They're not having that.
Well, right. They've already changed all the rules so that
they don't have to have
primaries.
They can have a convention.
Yeah.
Yeah. But interesting nonetheless, right?
Oh, very, because they're forcing states to change to the primaries. If you want to read about that, please do.
Yes, please.
Because it's, again, it's become very monarchish, I guess, to put it in the proper inflection, of President Trump and the Republican Party.
I think we all need to. So this Tuesday is Constitution Day. And so I want to put a plug in for, and this speaks exactly to what we're saying, is that we need to know how the system works as people, as citizens, and hold the political parties in, hold their feet to the fire and say, this is not democracy when you take the power of the people away to choose their candidates, right? So that's kind of why I like seeing 10 up on stage now, well, kind of naturally whittling it away, but you're still allowing the voters to have some kind of choice by going through the primary process. However, what's happening with the selection of who is in the debates, sometimes that seems a bit arbitrary because of who's getting money at, I mean, these are all things that I think voters need to ask themselves, right? So, yes, someone has a certain number of votes. Someone has a certain number of signatures, all these things. And I think I'm perfectly fine with that being the criteria, if that's what you set in advance for the debates. But I also think maybe we should see where the money is coming from in terms of some of the front runners. Not that should be held against them, but let the voters know. Let's be really transparent about who is running the party system, right? Is it the voter? Is it the person? Or is it donors and PACs?
Well, let me throw out here real quick before we move on that the Democratic National Committee did their own little underhanded behind-the-scenes mm-hmm. thing 4 years ago with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So it's not like it's only the GOP.
I told you, haven't changed in 400 years.
Right.
We can't help our own biology.
How solid do you think Joe Biden's lead is?
This is my personal opinion and not that of the Center for Politics. But okay. I don't think it's as strong as it would seem. I just think he's got very good name recognition. People are comfortable with him. They kind of know who he is, gaffes and all. And so because it's so early and we really haven't developed the platform, he is the leader, which means also that he has the most to lose going into the primary season. So I really think, you know, all of these debates, because he's the front runner, these series of debates are really either going to do one of two things, really develop the platform and the policies that he is committed to, or it's going to expose some of his weaknesses, such as being of a different era, being not as in tune with some of the, you know, having to really make up for things that he has said and done in the past, which I think are completely normal because he has been in government a long time. I remember in high school sitting around with my friends talking about whether he should run for office in the 80s. Right. So, I mean, you know, that's a long time. So he has the most to lose from all of this. But my personal opinion is that he won't last. But that's my own personal opinion. And I just think of it because of he's got a – it's kind of like the six-year itch or whatever, you know, that people are comfortable with him. But is that what you want moving forward? I think a lot of people back him right now because they think he can go up against Trump, President Trump. And so – I think a lot. That's where a lot of that support is coming from. But that's just from talking to people. I will also say that a lot of the people out on this. I don't do a lot of formal political analysis, but I'm out on the street with people.
Right.
And I'm in the Valley, and I'm in Charlottesville, and I'm all over the place. I still hear a lot of "I won't vote for a woman." So that is a concern. As a woman, that's very concerning to me. And I do think that there is some of that that is, oh, well, I'm going to back Biden because I can't stand the, like, Elizabeth Warren. She's too much like Hillary. That's a lot of what I hear from people. And I think that's unfair. And I don't think that happens to a man particularly. But that's another day's show. But I do think there's a lot of that sentiment out there. So I really didn't answer your question, did I? I guess the answer is I don't know.
I found an article in doing my homework for today. I think it was in the Washington Post. It was talking about Joe Biden's lead as of September 1st in the polls. And the article was talking about how early polls aren't always conclusive. It said in September 1st of 2008, the polls forecast Hillary Clinton versus Rudy Giuliani as an eventual
matchup.
And it turned out to be Barack Obama versus John McCain. And September 1st, 2012, they forecast Rick Perry held the lead, and it turned out to be Mitt Romney versus Obama. And then in 2016, however, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both enjoyed leads. And, of course, that is who we ended up with. So polls are mixed.
Yeah.
What do you know about the polls?
We can talk more about it. But I think we learned a lot about the polls in 2016, did we not?
I think on both sides of things, whoever you voted for, you learned a lot about the polls in the 2016 presidential race.
Yeah, we teach students about how at the Youth Leadership Initiative, we have lesson plans on that. And it's really important that you understand everything that goes into a poll. And they're problematic.
Yeah. All right. Let's take our first break. Meg Hubeck here from UVA Center for Politics as we talk a lot about politics. Be right back. All right, back in action with our guest, Meg Hubeck, as we talk about politics. Why? Because she's from the UVA Center for Politics, where she does the Youth Leadership Initiative, Global Perspectives on Democracy. Tell us a little bit about, you have guests from Mongolia, and you are teaching them all about what?
Well, first of all, I should mention that it's a team, and I am merely the curriculum instructional designer for it. But what the Global Perspectives on Democracy does is we take our mission of increasing civic engagement and we broaden it to a global audience. So in 2006, the center had its first international program. And what we try to do is increase civic engagement in countries outside of the U.S. borders, usually through grants with the U.S. Department of State. We partner with World Learning, which is an organization dedicated to similar goals as the Center for Politics. And what we try to do is we bring them here for leadership training. But the best part of the program is that we've built partnerships with organizations all over the Charlottesville, the area, to really showcase how Americans are civically engaged or not, because we talk about that too. We don't want visitors to come to this country and think that we're perfect. So we show them how our country, how we try to deal with our problems. So for the Mongolian group, we brought in organizations such as the Building Goodness Foundation, Charlottesville Area Riding Therapy, because horses are very popular in Mongolia. And I was thinking, you know, they could use what they already have to help their citizens. Some of the major problems in Mongolia include urbanization, pollution, poverty, unemployment, and transportation. So there are a lot of the population has had to move. You may have heard. There's one major city there, Ulaanbaatar, the capital, and people are moving there in large numbers, and it's unsustainable. And so they're trying to have to adapt because of climate change and because policies aren't addressing some of the issues that the formerly rural communities have. Everyone's moving to the city, and so now they're really having to solve some major, major issues. And so by coming here and seeing what groups in this, particularly nonprofits, are doing in this area, with or without government assistance, to alleviate some of the problems that we have, because we're not perfect here in Charlottesville. I know that we would like to believe that we are, but we aren't. And I think it's good for them, visitors, to see that even in a democracy that is as old as ours, you have to work at it. And so we bring in different groups. We bring in Central Virginia Legal Aid. We bring in Workforce Solutions from Piedmont Community College. I'm trying to think of other people we have had. I brought in my friend who's starting the Blue Ridge Children's Museum to talk about what she's doing. Just because what they're going to do when they return, the return part of the program, the State Department asks them to work on a project in Mongolia and provides them some funding. So what were they doing here for 2 weeks is learning about the United States, learning about civic engagement and citizen involvement in solving problems. So we've taken them, oh gosh, it's been so busy. I'll just use yesterday as an example. So yesterday was Saturday. And we started by celebrating Constitution Day at Montpelier. So we also visited Monticello to see the homes of our founding fathers and understand where their ideas may have come from, as well as exposing them to the history of slavery in this country and the contributions that enslaved laborers have played on our history. So we're really trying to show the United States, not as, oh, we snapped our fingers and here we are and we're perfect and you should be just like us. What we want them to see is that it's a process. So we started at Montpelier. They have a wonderful celebration for Constitution, by the way. I would highly recommend going to it next year. And then we went to the Somerset Steam and Gas Show, which is a real bit of Americana. I mean, it is a really wonderful way for anyone to understand our agricultural past and also that culture that has kind of grown up around agriculture and in the United States. It's fascinating. There are many, many different types of people there and of all different kinds of ilks. And so our group really had a great time walking around, talking to the people and getting to understand a little bit more about how we all live together. And so instead of staying in a core with just people like themselves at the university, we took them out into the thing, the in, out into the community. And of course, no trip to that area is complete without going to the barbecue exchange at Gordonsville, which once again is different from places that they might, and yet somewhat similar to what they might experience in Mongolia, because I don't know if you know, but Mongolia is excellent barbecue. And so they compared American barbecue to Mongolian barbecue and decided that barbecue exchange is delicious. And as I attest, I had a wonderful lunch. And then we ended the day by going to Alumni Hall for dinner and then to the UVA Florida State football game. And I taught them how to cheer, and we met students, and we went down on the field, and it was great. And I have to say, if you like, they got more of a taste of what America's like in one day than anybody else I have ever met. So it was wonderful. We were really tired, but things that they said were, you know, this is a much more fleshed out idea of what America is than when before we came, when we kind of had these, we talked about at the beginning how people view Americans maybe as being very individualistic, very materialistic, you know, but we've that, and so this is giving them this idea that, you know, really when you get down to it, people are all the same and they want to get along with each other, which is perfect, because that is exactly what I've been trying to do. That's my great passion in life, is to try to help people come out of their bubbles and try to get to know each other so that we can make our democracy stronger.
28 minutes after the hour with our guest, Meg Hubeck from UVA Center for Politics, talking about the guests from Mongolia who
Yeah, lead Mongolia.
So you're talking about people wanting to be together, needing to be together. But one of the big issues on the political topic has been socioeconomic stratification, ethnic and racial segregation. And a lot of it, when you put the Democratic candidates up on the board, is that they seem to be winning more of the GOP suburban votes than they did 4 and 8 years ago. But they're having such a hard time swinging any of the rural votes. Can you talk about any of that?
Yes, of course. Think about rural communities. What are they like? Picture that in your mind. I grew up in a what used to be kind of a rural community, but now it's not, in Maryland. And I will tell you, so you're further apart from your neighbor, right? And most of the times, the people that live around you in more rural communities look like you, right? And think like you. And that's fine, because that's what happens. But, okay, so I grew up in a slightly rural, well, rural community. But my parents always took me into the city, for all types of different activities, and made sure that I was interacting with people who were different from myself, because that was something that they valued. And so I think I was grew up just thinking a person is a person, and I like having friends of all different kinds, and I like interacting with people and getting out of my shell. But I think for a lot of people, getting out of your shell is very scary, because you haven't been exposed necessarily. Maybe you've been exposed, but not in a very important and serious way to the other, to others, right? And that people think differently from each other, and that's okay. And so we really, I think polarization in this idea of all for nothing politics, which is either you're with us or you're against us, has really played upon those fears of otherness. And so people who live, and so it's been really an urban-rural divide almost, which is the people we live on. If you live in a city, I lived in Baltimore for 10 years. I had all kinds of neighbors. I had neighbors who were Lumbee Indians. I had neighbors who were very poor. I had white neighbors. I had black neighbors. I had Mexican neighbors. I had everything was going on within this little block in which I lived. But I knew the people, and I could reach out and talk to them, and we interacted with each other. And so through interaction, I learned, oh, well, you know, they're just like us. They're just trying to work hard and get by, take care of their families. Whereas a lot of my friends who stayed in the rural area don't feel that way. And they feel like because they haven't had the experience of having to actually live closely with others. That's my own take on it, by the way. But I think what we can do, and I compare it to going over the mountain every day. So people are always asking me, you go over the mountain every day? First of all, it's not like I'm driving six white horses when she comes, right? I'm riding in a car in a highway, but that mountain is such like a barrier to people. It's like, well, over there, they're this way. They're all Trump fans. They're all like gun people. They're all this. They're all that. Whereas when you're over there, and then they're like, well, over there, they're all uppity and like snobby, and they're looking down their nose at us, and they're such liberals, and they can't see anybody else's point of view. This is why I like working in one and living in the other. I just like to be a part of both of those worlds. And I think when you bring people together, they realize that's not the way it is at all. It's just a perception. And that the perception has kind of been manipulated by this all or nothing system where it's you're either with us or you're against us. There's no middle ground. And people are in the middle are afraid to express that. They're afraid to say, you know, I agree with you on some things, but on some things I don't agree with you, because they're afraid they'll be ostracized from their in-group, as it were. And people, you know, social psychology again, people want to belong. That is like a basic need that we have because of evolution, because of all these other things. And so you don't want to be the person sticking out and saying, you know, I'm sorry, I don't agree with that. I agree with this, but I don't agree with that. Let's have a compromise on that. And that's really sad. So I really, I've been trying this thing where we go around and we have food, of course. Food being very important to people getting along and breaking down barriers. And with the Youth Leadership Initiative, we developed a program to try to help people help teachers talk politics in the classroom, which has become a taboo subject. And I've been taking that out into the communities and using it. And I was in I was up in Sperryville. I did a workshop in the Valley. I've done them a couple other places, showing people how to have civil conversations and how to get the process started. Because again, it's not magic. You don't snap your fingers. Oh, we're all getting along again. Hooray. But how to get the process started so that we can bring back this kind of like sense of togetherness. We just, you know, commemorated the 18th anniversary of September 11th. And I just remember I lived in Pennsylvania at the time, and how everybody put candles out on the street and had their flags hanging. And no matter who it was, people would say hello to you. And kind of there was this shared grief that kind of pulled us together. We need to have that all the time. And so what I've kind of dedicated the Youth Leadership Initiative and myself in my life to doing is trying in a small way to reconnect people and build up those relationships so that these people in the middle can have a voice. Right now, I think they're voiceless. They're drowned out by the far left and the far right. But a majority of the people are in the middle, and they're just sitting there quietly. I have a great political cartoon about this. It doesn't work on radio, but it's very funny, and it has bad words, so we can't use it. But it shows that people in the middle are just quietly sitting there saying, we don't agree with either one of you.
36 minutes after the hour with our guest, Meg Hubeck, who's pulling out comic drawings for radio.
Political cartoons. Political cartoons.
Political cartoons. Give props to your team, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I will. They'll love to hear it. Damon Irby and Mary Brown are the other two my coworkers that work on Global Perspectives. And we're in the trenches right now, but it's super, it's like the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. And it's certainly wonderful. I'm tired, but happy.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming today to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Meg Hubeck, her team giving her a little bit of time to stop by Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Meg Hubeck from UVA Center for Politics, the Global Perspectives on Democracy program, and the Youth Leadership Initiative. Can you explain, talk about political polarization. Can you explain why the GOP senators blocking election security legislation? That seems to be done purely for one-sided wishes.
Yes, and the Democrats do it as well. I mean, it's like gotten to the point where it's, like I said, there's no compromise, right? People don't hang out together, even in D.C. You know, they fly in on Tuesday morning and they leave on Thursday to go back to the district. So they're in Washington Tuesday, Wednesday. How are you getting to know people? You're not. You're only meeting with people in your caucus. You're like in an echo chamber. And with 24-hour news the way it is, you can design it so that you keep hearing the echo chamber over and over. So there's no mingling of our legislators in D.C. That's a problem. I think that's another thing that as – here's the bottom line for me, too. I don't hold the legislators accountable. I hold us, every single one of us, myself included, responsible for allowing it to get this way. People say, oh, it's the media. But we're not teaching young people, we're not teaching older people how to use media effectively. We're not going out to vote. We're not getting out and knowing our neighbors. We're not demanding policy that corrects some of these things. So saying to your legislator, do you know people of other political, you know, do you know your colleagues in the House or the Senate? Do you spend time with them? We don't ask those questions, but I think they would be really vital to restoring the political, to restoring compromise in our legislation and not just voting on something on party grounds. Remember, I talked earlier about social psychology. We want to fit in. Legislators are no different. And so they know that if they vote against the party line, they're going to be excluded.
Meg Hubeck here from UVA Center for Politics. As we talk about politics from all different types, the debate, political polarization, socioeconomic segregation. Let's come back and talk about civility.
Yay!
We'll be right back. All right, back in action with our guest, Meg Hubeck, UVA Center for Politics. You know, this came up earlier when we were talking about what we wanted to discuss today. And one of the first things you mentioned was the need for civility in politics.
Yes.
Well, it seems long lost.
Yes, but not, it's not that we can't recover it. Some people give me grief because they're like, why should I be civil to someone who is saying these things that are obviously wrong? But I offer to you, what does yelling, what does, I was taught two wrongs don't make a right. So last week, right before this program started, I did a workshop with Leadership Charlottesville, and they bring young leaders, potential leaders together to try to build a leadership program. And we talked about just this. So I was doing my civility workshops, as I call them. And I give them a bunch of case studies they're made up of very difficult people, people with really extreme views on the far left and the far right. And then using the structure that I've created for the Youth Leadership Initiative, they have to try to build a relationship with those people. It came from, I was listening to NPR one morning before the election in 2016, and a gentleman was on there and he was saying that he won't vote for a woman ever. And he doesn't believe that women should be in politics. And I wanted to turn the story off because he was making me angry, because I have emotions of anger. And but instead, I said, you know what, I'm just going to leave it on and listen until the story's over. So they kept on interviewing him about, well, they stopped and asked him, well, can you explain your experiences with leadership and maybe why that is? And so he went on to talk about growing up, where and when he grew up, that there were only white male people in charge. And so he associated white male people with being in charge, being competent, whatever, because he had never had the experience any other way. And so when he was introduced to the possibility, it frightened him. And so from there, the conversation went in different terms into well, what do you think could be done to try to kind of eliminate this fear or to make you more comfortable instead of, oh, you're wrong. Get out of here. Go. We're not talking to you anymore. And that really made me think, okay, so that strategy seemed to be a lot more effective than using bad language or tweeting something evil about a person. It was actually taking the chance to talk to the person and try to like make a dent in their armor as to why do you feel that way? And I don't know that we reach out to people that way. I practice in the car talking to the radio during interviews like that now. So I practice these skills in weird places in front of a mirror or, like I said, in the car or when the television is on. I drive my family crazy. My husband's sick of hearing it. But I practice what I would say if I run into these people. And what I find is that instead of responding from the base of, you know, instinct, what happens when you think about it and continue to probe and ask questions is that it moves up to the frontal cortex of your brain, and then you're more in control to A, listen, and also to ask questions that kind of provoke a conversation. People love to talk about themselves, as you can see. And so you're getting to know them a little bit better. So that's something that we're trying to do at the Youth Leadership Initiative, and at Global Perspectives and at the Center for Politics as a whole, is to try to get people to come together and share their stories and try to build understanding from those stories. We did a Common Grounds event, I guess, last fall, perhaps, where we brought students from all over the state of Virginia to UVA and had these kind of conversations with really, really positive effects. And we had every region of the state represented. So it can be done. I guess as citizens, I always put the blame on citizens because we always want somebody else to pick up our mess and make it right. But the buck stops with me. The buck stops with you. The buck stops with every single one of us. If things aren't the way we want them to be, I think we first need to ask, what are we doing? You know, are we asking these questions? Are we trying to create these relationships?
Meg Hubeck from UVA Center for Politics. So let me go back to Thursday night's debate. Julian Castro made a comment about Joe Biden's memory. Was that not civil, poor civility? Or was that just good politics?
Okay, so it could be both. But that's not the kind of politics I would want to practice. I don't think it was appropriate. I don't think calling out someone's infirmities or what you assume may be infirmities on live television in that way is appropriate. That's my personal opinion. I don't want to go there, right? But that's kind of what we have now. So that's what people have come to expect. It's the Jerry Springerization of politics. I'm sorry to offend Jerry Springer, by the way. But I mean, I think people want to see drama. If you flick through the television, all we see are shows that create dramas and anger among people.
That's how we have the current president.
Yes.
That's how he made his name. Well, that's one of the ways he made his name.
So we have to stop demanding that. As consumers and as citizens, we have to expect better. I mean, I was sitting at the football game last night, and there were gentlemen from the other team behind us. And they were there were children with us, and then there's our Mongolian group. And they are very loudly using foul language and yelling. Now, I realize it is a sporting event, but at what point do we put ourselves aside to say, gosh, there's other people around here who might not want to hear the F-bomb, you know, over and over again during the football game?
Well, you know, the University of Virginia has made its effort to stop with the good old song.
Right.
And the student body
responding to it.
Well, stopping with the not gay.
Mm.
And the student body continues to put in the F tech in that space.
Yes, it's not right.
And they haven't stopped. And with the university as a whole, as an administration, drawing in known alums and
my boss is one of them,
and famous current students,
right?
Trying to say stop, but as a large group, you can still hear it being yelled.
I heard it last night.
And I don't understand the point.
That's personal responsibility. Personal responsibility. We have not done a good job of, I guess, as a nation, of teaching. And I think that's one thing I've noticed from the Mongolians. Like last night, one of them bought popcorn and just passed it down to the entire group. Right? Most of us, if we buy popcorn at the football game, we eat it ourselves.
Yeah.
But they immediately think
that would probably be me.
I know. I have to admit, it would be me too. But think about that. They were thinking about everybody else in the group. Why? That's the personal responsibility. We are one among others. And I think in a democracy, and in America in general, we're very individualistic. But can we stop for a minute and try to think of those around us who may be offended by what you're saying? Or before you say something, stop, think, and say something intelligent instead of just shouting out, what was it? You lie, you're a liar, you stink. I don't know. I could go on and on, all of the things people say. But, I mean, I think it is a personal responsibility. I think when I'm teaching about rights and responsibilities, everyone, all the students want to, this is my right. Just when you're a kid, that's what you do.
Yeah.
But what about your responsibility? You don't get one without the other.
No, it drives me crazy.
And this whole, like, in the gun debates, I mean, I think we've really resolved down to, like you were saying, I'm going to come and take your gun, and my gun is here to take you. You know, where do we get with that? That's nothing. That's lacking personal responsibility. You have to think before you say something. You have to think about how it's going to affect other people. That's part of being a democracy.
I don't want to leave civility, but that carries me on to something that I found in social media. Candidate Beto O'Rourke apparently has called out to Facebook, Twitter, and Google to do more to fight disinformation in the 2020 election after a false claim that the gunman responsible for the August 31st mass shooting in Odessa, Texas, had a sticker supporting O'Rourke's candidacy on his truck. Not true. But someone put that out there, and then Facebook, Twitter, and Google allowed that to proliferate. And
okay,
so then it goes viral, and he's the one who's injured by it.
I'm going to also state that personal responsibility here. So last year, I spent the whole year developing a whole unit on media literacy, including social media and fake news. And
truly fake news.
Truly fake news. And it's really fun. If you ever want to get together, I have like a game show in there where you got it. You have to select the true news story or the fake news story depending upon what I show you.
Oh, I'd love to see
that. Oh, my gosh. It's so much fun. Anyway, in part of the lesson, we talk about a Facebook story that said that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump for president.
I'll guess that's fake.
And it was not true, but 960,000 people shared it. Now, some people may have shared it because they knew it was untrue. I received it from someone who I think wanted me to thought it was real. I'll just leave it at that. Okay. 960,000 times it was retweeted for free, right? That's free. Now, when I read it, I was like, oh, where is the source? So I immediately looked at the source, and then I went to the article, and you could tell from the site that it was not legit. Why? Because I have been trained in media literacy. And so that is one of my things that we have really worked hard on at the Youth Leadership Initiative, because that is a tool, right? And it's mostly older people that tweet me these outrageous stories because they're sitting around all day in a vacuum of just hearing people like themselves, watching whichever news agrees with them, and sharing these stories with me because they know I work in politics. But it is my responsibility as a citizen to be able to determine what is real news and what is fake news. Just because something is on CNN doesn't mean it's fake. Just because one, I don't know what that story was. I really didn't even follow it too much about something about, I don't know. Anyway, apparently they misreported something. They apologized, went on.
Oh, you're talking about the hurricane,
yes.
where they transposed, oh, right. Mississippi and Alabama.
Oh, no, this was about immigrants being put off boats.
Sorry.
Right? Which there is a kernel, there's truth to that, but the story, something they said in the story was not right. So someone said, oh, you can't believe this, it's on CNN. And I was like...
And a lot of people do the same thing about Fox.
Right. But did you go... You have to go and read the story. You have to look at where it's from. And we have tools for young people to make sense of it. That if you are doing a report and you can use a biased source, but don't just use one. Use one from one side and one from the other. It's better to use from the middle. So we have all these little tricks we teach students so that they can be media literate. And what I really need is for people to download it from my site and give it to older Americans. And try to help them. But I don't know if that's possible.
What do you think about the cost and value of candidates spending a lot of money to ask somebody to donate $1?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because actually on my my true or false, my fake news thing, I have a question just like that. It was like a town that advertised... for money because their budget was low. Like, it's like a catch 22. But I think the thing is that they don't really care so much about your dollar. What they care about is your email address, your address. Think about redistricting. Think about all of those things when you give them your information. They can find out all these other things about you now. And so that is worth the money that they put into getting your dollar.
All right, our guest is Meg Hubeck, UVA Center for Politics. Just a few minutes left. Thursday night's debate, Beto O'Rourke threw out that comment on guns. Hell yes, we're going to take your AK, your AR-15, your AK-57, if he were to become. Why would someone shout that?
I think there's a lot of anger, obviously, about the fact about these highly dangerous weapons. And I'm putting maybe a little bit of my personal spin on here. I want to clarify that. I do think that there is a lot of pent up anger that this has been allowed to continue. That we have had people in the military come out and say that these types of weapons really don't belong in the hands of people.
But why isn't someone shouting, hell yes, I'm going to lower your insulin prices?
The way they said it was not.
Why isn't something similar said about other, hell yes, I'm going to look, hell yes, I'm going to take these people out of prison at, you know,
right,
et cetera.
Why? Because it gets a reaction. People say it like that because it's meant to generate a reaction. Does that make it right? There's the question.
Certainly he made all the news. Do you think we'll see something similar at the October debate from someone else?
Of course. Of course. Because if you're in a field of 10, what are you trying to do? You're not the front runner, right? So what are you trying to do? You're trying to get as much time as you can out of that debate.
Just a few seconds left with Meg Hubeck. Who do you think might be the next two or three candidates that are forced to drop out?
Wang, maybe, the $1,000 man giving money away.
Yeah.
I liked what he has to say, but he just doesn't have enough traction, I don't think. I, you know what? I haven't thought about that question, but he just came to my mind because I saw a story on him this morning.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like that was a way to kind of get some attention as like a latch ditch effort.
One more.
Let's see. I don't want to say. I can't even.
All right. I'm going to let you go with
okay,
that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate you all letting me off the hook.
Meg Hubeck, the door. Next week, we're going to have a Baptist minister on to talk about modern religion, modern politics, and how they interact. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.